Hello, welcome to this zero-week conversation that we've entitled Hydrogen High Road. I'm Simon Blakey. I shall be moderating the session today, and we're going to have a conversation about how hydrogen might make its way into the energy markets of the future. First of all, let me introduce everybody. We have Gwenaëlle Avis-Huet, who is the Executive Vice President in charge of renewables, including hydrogen, at ENGIE. And she's also the CEO of ENGIE North America. We have Paul Browning, who is the President and CEO of Mitsubishi Hitachi Power Systems Americas. That's quite a mouthful, Paul. I guess you're used to saying it. I'm finding it quite a struggle. Can I refer you to you as MHPS?
Yes, that'd be great.
Okay, MHPS Americas. And then we have Richard Bucock, who is the Senior Vice President, Chief Information Officer, and Senior Special Advisor to the Chairman of Air Products. Richard, welcome. Paul, welcome. Gwenaëlle, welcome.
Thank you.
It's great. We've got an international energy major, we've got a major equipment manufacturer, and we've got a major supplier of industrial gases. That's pretty much the value chain on the supply side for hydrogen, if hydrogen has a future in the energy world. And these three people are individually interested and focused on this question because they are themselves engaged in the strategic direction of their companies. So it's good to be able to have them with us and to ask the question, is there a high road for hydrogen as we go through the next 10, 15 years? And what's the business context that could make it real? That's where we're going to go. That's what we're going to talk about. I'd like to start, if I may, by putting a question to Gwenaëlle. If that's okay by you, Gwenaëlle.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Really, what I'd like just to ask you is to say a word or two about ENGIE's position and interests in activities in hydrogen. You have a very strong background as a company in natural gas. That's well known, I think, by everybody in the world, a major global gas player. Are we right in thinking that these days you're as much focused on the prospects and possibility for hydrogen from electrolysis as you are from natural gas? What sort of plans do you have for the future?
Yes, thank you very much, Simon. We have a strong background on natural gas, and we think that natural gas is a transition fuel in the energy transition that we are seeing happening worldwide. But we want also to invest in natural gas on the long term. We truly think that natural gas is a long-term fuel. And therefore, we are working on greening the gas with two different dimensions. The first one is about biomethane, and the second one is about renewable hydrogen. And so for us, this is a major element, a major focus to make sure that we unlock the potential of hydrogen, renewable hydrogen, because it will help the development of other renewables. We know that there are some intermittencies questioned around solar and wind, and therefore we need something to cope with the intermittency, and hydrogen can play this role. So what we are working on is numbers of different applications of green hydrogen through concrete projects, because we know that there are plenty of solutions, applications for green hydrogen. For example, for large industries, sometimes they consume gas as a feedstock, and turning gas into hydrogen is an element to decarbonize the industry. For example, ammonia, refineries, chemistry, and things like that, it is really an enabler for decarbonization for large industry. It's the same also for mobility, large mobility like road, train, maritime sector, mining trucks, and things like that. And finally, green hydrogen can also be injected in the gas networks. So we are looking at very concrete projects to industrialize those developments on green hydrogen with very different usages for which hydrogen will make the difference.
Let's come to the concrete projects that you've got underway in a few moments. But you just mentioned a couple of things that I think are absolutely central to why it's interesting. One is the question of enabling renewables by dealing with the intermittency question. And the other is the sheer versatility of hydrogen in terms of the sectors of end use. On that first question of intermittency, Paul, perhaps that's a good opportunity to turn to you, because I think one of the projects that you're dealing with as power systems is indeed in Utah is actually specifically addressing how to make renewable power, something that is sustainable throughout the day, the week. Can you tell us a word or two about that, and whether you share Gwynell's view that this is a key issue for hydrogen?
Yeah, I'm definitely on the same page as Gwynell, and maybe I would just state it a little bit differently, though. You know, we've been really focused on decarbonization of the power sector. And if we take the United States as an example, you know, the U.S. power sector has been decarbonizing now for the past two decades. It's about 40% lower in carbon intensity today than it was in 2001. And we're asking ourselves the question, what needs to happen to continue the decarbonization of the U.S. power sector? We just think it's a two-decade trend that we think is investable. So we've been asking ourselves, you know, the success we've had in the past has been through retiring coal-fired power generation and replacing it with a combination of natural gas and renewables. And as Gwynellen said, the intermittency of renewables in the past has been offset by the flexibility of natural gas power generation. But in some parts of our country, they've already retired all of their coal. And so we've been asking ourselves the question, what comes next after all the coal is retired? And we think the clear answer in phase two is we have to start replacing natural gas power generation with a combination of renewables and storage. And when we look at the storage issue, we think that there's a role for short-term storage and a role for long-duration storage. The short-duration storage, we think lithium-ion batteries are going to be a very good solution, and we have a business in that area. But as we get beyond about 8, 10, 12 hours of duration, lithium-ion battery storage gets prohibitively expensive, and we need a different solution, and that's where hydrogen really, really fits well. We're actually involved in two projects in Delta, Utah. One project is with the Intermountain Power Agency, and this was going to be a large 840-megawatt combined cycle power plant using our gas turbine technology, where we've guaranteed the capability to burn both natural gas and hydrogen for power generation. At commercial operation in 2025, we've guaranteed 30% hydrogen capability. And then we've also committed that no later than 2045, we're going to have 100% hydrogen combustion capability on those gas turbines. So we have the ability to turn hydrogen into electricity with that project. And then we have the next question is, where's the hydrogen going to come from? We have an adjacent project called ACES, where that's the Advanced Clean Energy Storage, where we are going to be producing renewable hydrogen through electrolysis, and we're going to be storing it underground in a large salt dome for the long-term storage of the hydrogen. So, you know, we felt like it was important to bring a total solution here, not just our typical sort of OEM scope, but we really had to help our customers solve the fuel supply question as well.
Richard, Air Products has the company background is both very much in the energy world and in the industrial gases world. Hydrogen, I guess, if it's going to make it into the energy world, is going to bring those two things together. How does this fit with Air Products' planning and hopes for the future?
So, Simon, thanks very much for the question. It's great to be here. I appreciate everyone joining us today. You know, where to start? In terms of hydrogen, one of the things that we look at in terms of the technologies that are available for making hydrogen, we see things like SMRs and gasification and even electrolyzers in terms of being here and present today.
Can we just spell that SMR out, an acronym for those who don't really not necessarily know what it is?
Okay, so a steam methane reformer, also known as an SMR, along with gasification, electrolysis, they're very much today's technologies that are available for making hydrogen and have been around for a long time. We see a lot of technologies combined with carbon capture, utilization, and storage, something for today and tomorrow. And then in the future, hydrogen very much playing an incredibly important part in the future energy mix. In terms of Air Products, you know, we've been making hydrogen probably since the 1950s, 1960s. Certainly anyone that remembers things like Apollo missions and space shuttles, majority of those missions use hydrogen as a fuel. Today, we're the biggest on-purpose producer of hydrogen. We make 2 billion cubic feet per day of hydrogen every day in the U.S. Gulf Coast and transport it over hundreds of miles by pipeline. And of course, for a number of applications, for many years, we've been supplying it as liquid hydrogen that we transport over the road. So the utilization of hydrogen as an energy source, as a feedstock, as a raw material, is very clearly established. The carbon component that comes along with some of the existing technologies is a really important topic in today's world. And we're very proud to run one of the biggest CO2 capture and storage units in Port Arthur, Texas, that recovers CO2 from an existing vent gas and redeploys that for other value-adding uses. So, yes, for air products, we have been long in the hydrogen business, and we see hydrogen in terms of our future playing and continuing to play a very important part.
Some interesting points came out of that. I'd be very, I'd like to hear what Gwenaëlle and Paul have to say on that, because you mentioned your long tradition of producing hydrogen, the fact you have a big role. That is, I think, what for the most part, we would these days, since we give colors to hydrogen, we call gray hydrogen because it's got CO2 that's being associated with it. But you also mentioned carbon capture and storage, a project in, did you say Port Arthur, Texas? And that is the way that's talked about to turn gray hydrogen from steam methane reforming into blue hydrogen,
right?
Reducing the carbon emissions. Carbon capture and storage, however, has a lot of challenges in a lot of parts of the world. Gwenaëlle, this must be something that ENGIE faces, that you're operating worldwide. Some places, do you actually look at carbon capture and storage as an option for decarbonizing future hydrogen, or are you rather more focused on electrolysis? What's your take on that?
So I would say that blue hydrogen can be considered in the transition period, and we are looking at it, but we are very much engaged into the development of green hydrogen economy. So basically, our main focus is around green hydrogen. That's
interesting, because I mean, the other thing that I think ENGIE is well known for is gas storage. Or, you know, the company historically was a big operator of storage. It's all been spun out.
Still the case, huh?
It's still the case. Okay, it's still the case. Any projects involved that look at the storage of hydrogen along the lines that Paul's been talking about?
Yes, we are looking at that. We have one project in France that could use some storage to store part of the hydrogen that we will produce on site, were based on solar. So we are developing this kind of project, yes.
I think, Simon, if I could just add, you know, one of the interesting things around hydrogen is the, as Gwenaëlle mentioned earlier, is biomethane as being a transition feedstock. There's a number of cases, some of the facilities that we have built around the world that take biomethane and produce that to convert that into hydrogen. And of course, while different jurisdictions will apply different interpretations of that, you know, converting the global warming potential of biomethane into hydrogen, and admittedly with perhaps some CO2 emissions that can then be further captured and stored, is an interesting component to the transition in our view.
Well, I know that a number of jurisdictions are talking about targets of net zero carbon. The net bit is becoming quite important. So the idea of using biomethane as a feedstock and then doing something and getting the carbon out is kind of a double win if it can be got there.
Precisely.
So it's interesting to hear that. I mean, you three are involved as serious business people. You are not think tankers. You are not policymakers. You are genuinely looking at this as a serious business opportunity for your companies.
You know, one thing I would throw in there is, you know, we have a global strategy we're deploying, and it's very much a learn by doing strategy. It's based on real projects with real customers. I talked about the green hydrogen projects in Utah. We also have a blue hydrogen project in the Netherlands, where we're using natural gas and SMR, and we're capturing the CO2 and sequestering it offshore in a gas field. And then we have a third project in Australia where we're using coal and our gasification technology to convert coal into hydrogen. And then we are capturing the CO2 and sequestering it. So, we're looking, you know, we really want to have experience in really every form of hydrogen. We're also very involved in the Australian project in liquefying that hydrogen and transporting it by sea to Japan. In our in our Utah project, we're going to be looking at underground storage and also pipeline applications of hydrogen. So we're really trying to learn by doing in sort of every aspect of producing, storing, transporting, and combusting hydrogen.
Okay, thank you very much. That's very helpful. In a moment or two, I'd just like to turn to talking about costs and markets. But just before I do that, Gwynell, Paul mentioned a couple of projects there around the world. You're active in Australia as well, is that right? And in the Netherlands? Are they the same projects?
Yeah, so I mentioned before that we are looking at usages, and basically we're developing large-scale projects in different usage situations. First, for the industry, as I mentioned, to develop decarbonized H2 for industrial processes, especially for refineries, chemistry, or ammonia production. So we have projects in Australia, in Chile, or in Netherlands. Basically, we are looking for renewable energy powered, renewable H2 plants, meaning that we produce renewable on-site, and therefore we produce by electrolysis the H2. And we are talking about double-digit megawatt, and the end game for us is gigawatt by 2030. This is the end game that we're looking for the industry, because there is a request, there is demand to progressively decarbonize some of the large industry sectors. We have been also developing projects on mobility, especially in France, with numbers of electrolyzers, hydrogen refueling stations, based on renewables, and I think that this is also one area for which the demand will continue to grow. And maybe one last example is that we are working on injection this time, injection of hydrogen into the existing gas network. So not only for the power production in terms of decarbonization of the power side, but also in injection in the existing gas networks. And so today we have pilot demonstration projects where we inject 20% of hydrogen into the networks, and we are testing that and we're learning from that in order to have, yes, progressively the networks being greener with biomethane and at some point with hydrogen.
So it's across the whole range of the potential energy use, industry you mentioned, transport, and injecting into for distribution grids. And this must be music to your ears as a producer of hydrogen, Richard. I mean, this is presumably, if you move out of the niche of ammonia and refineries to a much wider world, then the upside is, in terms of volume for a company like yours, must be quite significant.
Yeah, I mean, we see the opportunity as being significant. We also see the complexities and the challenges in terms of, as I think you suggested, moving on to some discussions around costs and the challenges that we have to overcome. You know, if we look back only 30 years, the world was very comfortable at that time using carbon-based fuels, and a lot of our industries and our technologies have developed around that. As we decarbonize them, the opportunity is there to move to hydrogen, but at the same time, dealing with the CO2 and ensuring that for the consumer, what is offered can be cost competitive. Because at the end of the day, there is a very large proportion of the world that is still in an energy deficit and is still developing and is still building consumption of energy. And that's one of the reasons that we see some of the emerging markets being particularly important. And as I mentioned earlier, we have a lot of experience of all sorts of different unit operations, electrolysis. I've run electrolyzers myself, as well as steam methane reformers. You know, we believe that the technology really exists to make that step change. What we have to do is to make sure that we can satisfy the economic expectations of societies around the world. Because at the end of the day, people need affordable energy.
That's a great point. And one of the things we're excited about with our project in Delta, Utah, is it's the first phase of it. We're going to need about a gigawatt of electrolysis. You know, the entire electrolysis industry today is 100, 125 megawatts per year. So our one project is going to really help scale this industry. And of course, there's other projects happening as well. And so just like we saw with onshore wind, with PV solar, with lithium ion battery storage, as we scale up electrolysis, we're already finding very large economies of scale in the project in Utah.
Yeah, I mean, the work that we've done in the IHS Market Hydrogen Forum very much focuses on economies of scale as a way of reducing electrolyzer costs. Developing dedicated renewables in order to get the load factor on the electrolyzer up, and of course, continued expectation of falling costs for renewables. Those are all, I think we're all pretty clear that the trends are in that direction in all those three areas. Any opinion from the three of you as to how quickly we can get there? Gwenaëlle, you've mentioned some numbers in terms of the timing of your ambition to get from double-digit megawatts, triple-digit megawatts into the gigawatt scale. And Paul, you've said a gigawatt for one project already is what you're planning. How what do you think in terms of timing? Will you have a shot at that? Richard first.
So in terms of timing, you know, one of the reasons that we talk about our, you know, our today, our tomorrow, and the day after tomorrow as part of our chairman's strategy in this space is that we recognize that there's definitely a runway. But I would expect, if we look at the types of innovation that we've seen in other industries, within the next 10 years, we will be in a very different position. To give an example that I've used at other CERAWeek IHS events, you know, we looked at the flat screen industry, the screens that all of us are looking at today, working in that industry in the 1990s. And at that time, it was $10,000 an inch for a screen. So an iPhone would have cost $6,000 to $10,000. Today, iPhones are ubiquitous. The importance of the types of projects that both Gwenaëlle and Paul have highlighted and the projects that we're working on is driving scale, driving innovation is the type of thing that we know can drive down the unit cost. It isn't going to happen tomorrow, but it is through focused innovation and focused development. You know, for us, hydrogen is going to be a part of the energy future as it is today, but in the next 10 years, it's going to be an even bigger part, and 20 years into the future, it's going to be huge.
I'm tempted to say, Richard, that you're well worth $10,000 a square inch. Gwenaëlle, what do you think about the timing?
I agree with Richard, and what we see is that today there is a difference of cost, and we know that because, for example, the production cost of renewable hydrogen is between 3.5 to 7 euros per kilogram, whereas the gray hydrogen produced by fossil fuels will be around 1.5 euros per kilogram. So to bridge the gap, there are two components: the renewable power side, decrease of cost or production cost, and the other one is the electrolysis cost, where we see a trend of decreasing cost in the 10 coming years. So the parity between blue and gray hydrogen is expected to be reached by 2030. And 2030 is tomorrow. So that's why investing right now is absolutely critical.
Paul, do you have what do you think in terms of timing? I mean, you said a project already underway looking at a gigawatt.
Yeah, in February, we received full notice to proceed on a $1.9 billion project, the Intermountain Power Agency. So we're underway. The commercial operation date for that is 2025, and 30% of 840 megawatts will be, you know, will be available with hydrogen production. We are already talking to other customers who are very interested in projects that would have commercial operation dates after 2025. So I think that 10-year time frame sounds about right in terms of having actually several projects in the ground at utility scale producing a lot of electricity from renewable hydrogen.
Okay, that's very interesting. I mean, it's quite clear that you all have more than just a strategic intention to get on with this, and it's a series of some very serious concrete projects. I guess, I mean, you mentioned that you had the go-ahead, Paul. I guess the local policy support is actually pretty important for the first big scale projects that will happen. Are you finding any common theme things that work best in terms of getting public policy to support business development of hydrogen? Obviously, you've got a particular case in point in Utah, and I don't want any company secrets or specifics, but there might be some pointers you can give you there, Paul. Gwenaëlle, I think you're operating in all sorts of places around the world. Are there policy things that are sort of policy tools that you find preferable, particularly interesting and helpful in terms of getting it off the ground?
So maybe first, within the total cost of renewable hydrogen, 70% accounts from the electricity, the cost of the electricity. So we have to develop projects where we have very favorable condition to develop renewables, where renewables is very competitive. And so that's why we are developing projects right now in South Africa, in Australia, in Northern Europe, in some favorable locations, so that we have very competitive renewable sources. And the second element is to have support politically and regulatorily on the regulatory context. For example, support like grants, subsidy on the offtake side. I think it's also quite significant in the business plan that we have. And the good news is that we see more and more countries that are setting very favorable regulatory schemes. Hydrogen becomes more and more at the top of the radar of many countries. So that's extremely positive. Now the question is that after COVID, we would like to make sure that the recovery plans that will be designed across the globe will dedicate specific attention to hydrogen. Even though it's more costly right now, it is a quick win. And so we need to invest right now, and we need to convince the politicians, the regulatory administrative bodies that this is a no-regret option, and this should be part of the recovery plans post-COVID.
From our point of view, we tend to look at it from the demand side. So we're looking for parts of the world that are into this phase two decarbonization period, where they have a lot of renewables on their grid. They've already retired most of their coal, and they need storage. And they don't just need storage, they need long duration storage. So if we can find a market like that, and California is a great example, where they need long-term storage, then we have some confidence that we can go in and work with our customer to help the right regulatory things happen, because it's a region that needs long-duration storage. So that and there's a lot of places around the world that are getting to that phase two decarbonization period, where this is a technology that they need to succeed. And one of the things I was music to my ears, our customer, LADWP, who's going to operate the Intermountain Power Project, one of the comments that they made is there's no way to 100% renewable power without hydrogen.
And that was a point, in fact, that you made early on, Manel, wasn't it, that it's a booster for the renewable power sector to develop this. Richard, do you want to have the last word on this topic? We're coming close to the end of our half hour here. So.
Yeah, I think, just like everyone that's on this call, we all work in many, many different countries around the world, and we see the different jurisdictions, different regulatory frameworks. You know, one of the things I would say is we have projects going on in every region, and those projects are shaped by the regulatory framework and essentially the energy strategy and the energy desires. We have activities that we've had for many years in places like California, which has been talked about a lot. But in other parts of Asia and even in India, we're starting to see governments that have a clarity of strategy and a firmness of purpose. You know, one of the things that is important, having worked for a few years in different countries as related to the energy sector, is making sure that we have confidence that the types of policies that are going to be in place are going to be in place for the medium to long term, because we are making big bets. You've heard some of the numbers today in terms of Gwynell and Paul's aspirations. You know, we already have billions of dollars of assets invested in hydrogen, and we intend to invest many billions more. You know, working in a place where there is a level of confidence of the stability of legislation and regulation that is a level playing field and enables us to invest with confidence in the long term with our build, own, operate model. That's the sort of thing that we're looking for.
Thank you all, the three of you, very much indeed for the contribution that you've made to this conversation. It's interesting, I've taken the view that as representing the IHS Market Hydrogen Forum, I shouldn't be evangelical about hydrogen. I should have an open mind and say maybe it will be part of the future, maybe not. As a result of this conversation, I must say, because of your very serious business focus, and the only genuine personal commitments that you have to the projects and the plans that your companies have underway, you're tilting me to being rather more positive than I was at the beginning of the conversation. So thank you very much, Gwynell, Paul, Richard. This brings our CERAWeek conversation to a close. So having thanked our three panelists, I'd also like to thank you, the listeners and watchers, for listening and watching. And we hope you very much valued and appreciated the insights that the panelists have brought. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.